Today is Monday. It's August 25th, 2025, and this is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Dave Mertz. Dave spells his last name M-E-R-T-Z. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Dave. How are you today?
I'm doing well.
Great. Dave, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
You certainly may.
Thank you so much. At the end of the interview, last time we met, you had worked for the Idaho Department of Transportation there in the fall of 1984 on a survey crew and had sent out some applications for working in the forest with the Forest Service and had been offered a job on the Coconino out of Mormon Lake and took that job in the spring, summer of 1985. Can you pick that thread up?
Yeah. So then I spent the summer. We were basically the fire prevention engine for the district, and that involved doing a number of public contacts, meeting with various groups, as well as assisting in any firefighting that came along. And we were actually fairly busy that summer. So,
do you remember the groups, the public contacts that you made? Who would that have been with?
It was a big variety. A lot of them were like youth groups, summer camps.
Okay.
And then also some adult gatherings of different kinds that invited us to come and talk with them.
So, oh, cool.
Yeah.
And would you bring your engine and show your engine off? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We would bring that and show the kids, you know, how to spray water and, you know, the kinds of things that we did. So
cool.
It was fun.
That's good PR.
It was.
Nice. Who was your, so did you have a crew boss? What was the chain of command there?
Yeah, we had an engine boss that I worked for. And then above him, we worked for Larry McCoy. He was the district fire prevention technician.
What do you remember about Larry?
Oh, Larry was a good guy. I enjoyed working with him, and he made an effort to get out and work with us and touch base with us, and I learned a lot from him. He's a good guy.
Where was his office? Was he out of Flagstaff or where?
Well, the Mormon Lake District office, which is just south of town there.
Okay.
You know.
Yep. On the way toward Lake Mary from downtown Flagstaff.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. So it would be maybe an hour's drive for him to get out, or a little less than that, to get out and visit with you all.
Yeah. 45 minutes or so.
Okay. What was Larry like?
Pretty easy going, and you know, we made a few mistakes and. He was, he didn't get too worked up about it and, helped us to try to, you know, do things right.
What kind of mistakes did you make?
One time, we had worked a small fire and, you know, we thought we had put it out, and then a couple days later, one of the lookouts turned in a smoke report, and we started looking, seeing what was that. It was like, uh-oh.
Oh, no.
That sounds like where we were. And, yep, indeed, when we got there, it was the fire that we had supposedly put out and didn't do a good enough job. And, you know, what you're supposed to do is, even when you put a fire out, you go back and check it, you know, a couple, three times just to make sure. And And we got busy, I guess, and didn't do that. So that was kind of embarrassing. And then there was another time where we kept getting flat tires all the time because those roads down there, and we would, there was a gas station that we would, we were there so many times, they just would like to let us use their equipment.
Oh my gosh, but to change the tire, fix the tire. How cool is that?
Yeah, they would, I mean, I don't know how many flats we fixed, but anyway, one time we must have not tightened all the lug nuts, and we're driving down the interstate, started hearing some noise, and we pulled the engine over, and all but one of the lugs had been sheared off.
Oh my gosh.
The only thing keeping us going was one last lug there, you know.
Was waiting to go.
Oh yeah, we're really lucky that we didn't lose a wheel.
Yeah.
So then we had to get that all fixed, and he helped us with that. And then another time I was driving, and there was a limb across the road, and rather than get out and do what we should have done, which would have been pulled out of the road, I just drove over it, and somehow it snapped up and smashed the front windshield.
Oh my gosh.
We had to get a new windshield. So he had some patience for us.
How old was he?
I'm going to guess he was probably in his mid-30s or so.
Okay. So he'd been out there and done that. And
yeah, he'd been around. Yeah.
Right. Who else was on your crew that you remember?
There was just three of us, and we lived at, this remote, it's a lookout tower. I should have looked up the name. I've forgotten it now, but we had a little cabin and a trailer that we lived up there.
Okay.
And so then there was the guy who was our engine boss, but then there was another guy who, he had just gotten out of the army and had been an army ranger, and he was kind of gung ho, but he knew nothing about firefighting, but so I don't know. It was kind of interesting hearing his stories and all that kind of stuff.
I bet.
Yeah.
He must have kind of been itching for action, of which there
was
not all that much.
Yeah, he was. He was that kind of guy.
But did you have kind of a busy fire season that year, 1985?
Yeah, I did. I mean, we didn't, I forget what the hourly wage was. It wasn't much, but I think I managed to save something like $6,000 over the summer, which that's not too bad for back in those days.
That's really good.
Yeah, I was happy about it.
So was this a seasonal job, or were you planning to work, all year on the coke? What was the plan there?
Well, it was a seasonal job.
Okay.
I mean, there was very few permanent jobs that were available back then.
Okay.
So we were supposed to work into October sometime, and all of a sudden, one day the AFMO comes and tells us, next week's your last week. So I think I got laid off at like the end of September or something.
Okay. What were you thinking to do for the fall, winter, and spring of 85, 86?
Well, that's where I came up with this idea. There was, because there was a lot of people back then that would work these seasonal jobs. There still are, but not like it was back then. And then they would, save the money up while they're working, and then go on some adventure for the wintertime. Some will go down to Mexico and all that. Well, so I came up with this idea. I want her to go to Europe, so I, after I got laid off, I went over to traveled around in Europe for 5 weeks.
Wow, where'd you go? What'd you see?
Oh, my. I got to see a lot. I flew into England, London first, and then took the ferry over to Amsterdam, and then I had a Eurail pass, a month-long Eurail pass, and just got on the train and started traveling. And I really, I don't know how many countries I got to go to, but quite a bit.
Wow.
Yeah.
Lovely.
And, it was nice. One of my good adventures. And so I traveled around there and then made my way back home.
Came back stateside. This would have been mid-November, maybe?
It was I made it all the way until December. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was nice. A nice time to be in Europe because nothing was busy. You know, it was...
Yeah, the tourist season was kind of over then.
Yeah, tourist season was over. Things were not crowded, and the weather wasn't too bad, so it all worked out pretty well.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of would have been, might have been a little bit of a letdown coming back to the States then.
Yeah, because then I had to figure out what I was going to do next.
Yeah.
And you know, I knew I could go back to the Mormon Lake District, but I had a buddy who lived in San Diego, and he said, well, come on out here, and you know, maybe you can get some work for the winter time or whatever. So
okay.
I did that, and I was kind of bumming around San Diego, and I got, I don't know, a little discouraged, I guess, and something made me decide, well, I'm going to go into the Army Recruiter Office and see if I can get into the Officer Candidate School.
Okay.
And so I did, and I'm sitting there talking to them for some period of time, and they said, well, you could do that, but it's kind of a drawn-out process and all that. How would you like to go up to Monterey, California, and learn a language and all this? And I was like, well, that sounds kind of fun. And next thing I knew, I was downtown San Diego taking this test, and then I signed up for the Army.
Okay.
Which was kind of kind of not like me, but I did it.
Uh-huh.
So,
when you were in Europe, were you working on any language skills there?
A little bit. I mean, I knew a little bit of German, but
okay.
not very much. But in this process, they let you put down your preference of languages that you want to learn.
Okay.
And I put Russian as my number one, and that's what I ended up getting. So.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where did you go to basic?
Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. So,
okay. How was that?
There. Well, I got there. It was kind of funny because I was supposed to. I went to Denver to. They go, it's a processing center there. I was supposed to join the Army on April 1st, April Fool's Day. And then something got mixed up as appropriate for April Fool's Day, and it didn't work out. And then April 2nd, and then me and another guy flew to St. Louis, and the bus picked us up, and we got to go to basic training, which was an adventure as well. And, you know, in southern Missouri, that time of year, it was, people wouldn't think it, but it was cold. gold is because that humid gold. And but then by the time I left, which was in June, it was hotter than blazes.
So. Yeah, yeah.
But overall, it was, you know, it was quite an experience.
Okay, I mean, as an outsider looking in, I would assume that you would have brought some pretty good skills to basics. I mean, you know the out of doors, you're comfortable out of doors. And some of the other people there in the basic training might not have had that skill.
Oh yeah, well that was true to that. I mean, I remember we had a section where they were trying to teach map reading, you know, and I was like, oh boy. I mean, this is some real basic stuff.
Right.
But these people, you know, there was a number of them that, yeah, probably had never spent a night outdoors in their life.
And had never seen a topographic map or even knew it existed.
No. Right, right. Yeah, exactly. So it was all brand new to some of them. And
right.
I remember one time, we had this bivouac where we had to spend the night out there. And one of the guys thought he was going to be clever, and he was going to camouflage his helmet, and he had picked some foliage to stick in his helmet.
No.
And all that. It was poison ivy.
Oh, no.
He ended up getting a real bad case of poison ivy out of that deal.
Yeah.
So, yeah, some of it was kind of, there were definitely some fun times, some things to laugh about.
Yeah, and also you were from the Forest Service has a command and control structure. You know where you are.
Yeah,
you know who your leaders are. You do what they say.
Right. Yeah.
And
there's some similarities. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So some of that would have been, you would have been familiar with, where others wouldn't necessarily have been.
Yeah. So then after that, yeah, I went out to Monterey, California. And spent a year out there learning Russian, so, and I really enjoyed Monterey. And it wasn't, they weren't so much into all the Army stuff there. It was more about just, you know, the important thing was you were there to learn a language, and that was your primary task.
So that was,
but it was all,
sort of
it
Russian, was all, Russian immersion.
Yeah, yeah, it was 6 hours a day.
Wow.
And we had, our instructors, most of them were Russian Jews who had, you know, they had left Russia. And so these were native speakers and stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was tough. A lot of tests and all that. I thought it was harder than anything I did when I was in college, actually. It was more stress involved with it, really.
Wow.
Well,
yeah. Could that have been, let me just figure out, you would have been in, 26 or 27?
26.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, college, you're in there and you're 18, you're 19, you're not really thinking that seriously about it, but I would assume that you were taking this pretty seriously.
Yeah, I was, and I had never, even in high school, I didn't take any other languages, and so it was all kind of new to me.
Okay.
But I did enjoy it, and then by the end, I graduated with honors there.
Whoa.
So I did pretty good.
Nice.
Yeah. So from there, then they sent us to San Angelo, Texas, Goodfellow Air Force Base, and some more training there. And then Fort Devens, Massachusetts. And then by that time, I'd already been in the Army for 2 years already.
Wow.
And then they got my first duty assignment, which was in Nuremberg, Germany.
So hang on a second. Your tour only lasts 2 years, isn't it?
No, 4 years.
Oh, it's 4 year tour. Okay.
Yeah, for that job, you had to sign up for 4 years because they were putting so much.
So much effort into you.
Yeah, all the training. But for the Army, they had the lowest commitment because at Monterey, we were there with all the other services, and like the Air Force and Marines, they made you sign up for 6 years.
Oh wow! Okay.
So okay. Yeah, 4 years is what my commitment was.
All right. I'm sorry. So you said they sent you to where in Germany?
Nuremberg.
Okay.
Nuremberg, Germany. And
had you been there on your 5 week?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I didn't go to Nuremberg. I truthfully didn't know much about it.
Okay.
But it is it's a beautiful German city, and it got heavily damaged in World War II from the bombing. But they did a really good job of rebuilding and it's a beautiful city.
Nice.
Yeah, I was lucky. Where we were stationed at was at an Army airfield just south of the city there. So
okay.
Yeah, and what we did was we had these Black Hawk helicopters, which had special listening gear and stuff in the back, and so there would be two of us linguists that were riding back there, and then we would fly along the East German and Czechoslovakian border and listen to what the Russians, East Germans, and the Czechs were talking about over there, so... that's what I did.
So would this be like listening to their radio stations and their TV stations?
Nope.
Or was this more?
It was more their tactical communications.
Okay.
With their military.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So two-way radio communications.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what we did. And then you would try to gather intelligence from that, from what they were doing and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did that work for you? I don't know anything about Russian or Russian dialects. The training that you received in Monterey, how did that serve you listening to these communications?
Well, in Monterey, it was strictly just learning the language. But then when they sent us to Texas, to San Angelo, that portion of it was you would go and they had all these recordings of actual Russian communications, and so you would listen to those and then you would transcribe it, and you got to learn kind of, you know, how Russians talk on the radio.
Got it. Okay.
Their command structure and all that kind of stuff. So by the time I got over to Germany, I was fairly up on, you know, the kinds of things they say and how they communicate and all that. So
okay.
I was pretty prepared for it by then.
And you'd had some exposure to helicopters with the Forest Service doing fire, so it wasn't new for you to step into a helicopter, except the Black Hawk might have been different.
Black Hawk's a pretty nice helicopter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was a state-of-the-art back in the mid-80s, wasn't it?
Yes. That's right, because when I first got there, we still had the Hueys. But then just a couple months after I was there, we got a shipment of the new Black Hawks that came in. So,
wow. Okay.
Yeah, they're brand new. And it's a nice helicopter.
I'm assuming that you would, your job was to listen, but then you had to transcribe.
Yes.
So you
take these, you would record it while you're flying.
Okay.
And then when you got back, you'd take those tapes and then we had to go to a SCIF, a secure facility, and then you go in there and transcribe those tapes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a little easier than having to take shorthand notes while you're flying, because that's a great recipe, I'm thinking, to get air sick. But
yeah, I never did get air sick, which kind of surprised me. But
oh, good for you.
Never did.
Okay.
Which I was grateful for that.
And but, when did the Berlin Wall go down? This was...
Well, yeah, that's... So then... I was there at the Berlin Wall came down in 89.
Okay.
And I was there in 89. I had already been to Berlin a couple of times already. But then, you know, everything just started to kind of fall apart for the Russians and everything. I mean,
hey Dave, hang on a second. I want to back up a little bit. Well, let's kind of slowly head into this, because I'm thinking in your reconnaissances in the with the Black Hawk, were you hearing this kind of breakdown maybe in 87, 88? Were you kind of aware that, you know, something was up just from what you were listening to?
That's a good question, but not really.
Okay.
That wasn't being discussed in the within the ranks of the military. And my guess is they were probably careful about saying anything.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, it was over a course of, I don't know, what, 2-3 months?
Yeah. I mean, it seemed like that
everything
fast.
Yeah, everything just started to fall apart, and then East Germany was still kind of like the last holdout.
Right.
And then that just happened like overnight. All of a sudden, they were tearing down the wall, and where I was in Nuremberg, we were only about 30, 40 miles from the eastern border. And then, you know, they just opened everything up. And the next thing we knew, all these East Germans in these crummy little Russian cars were coming over to see what West Germany was like, you know?
Okay.
And they were coming into Nuremberg and just kind of amazed. You know, to see it's a modern city, and compared to what their experiences was, so it was a pretty neat experience to be there.
Did you go over to the wall and did you see people tearing it down?
No, I've been to Berlin twice, but that was before the wall came down, and then I didn't go there after the wall came down.
Okay. Had you made any friends in Nuremberg, any German friends by that time?
Yeah.
What were they saying about it?
Well, so I had, when I first got there, one of the guys that I worked with, he was married and he lived off base in a little German village that was close by. And one of his neighbors in the apartment was this older German lady. And, so they were good friends, and I'd go over there and have dinner with them and stuff. And then he got transferred back to the U.S. but anyway, she still was, her and I became, good friends.
Cool.
And, I would go there all once a month or so. She'd cook dinner for me and stuff. But, then when the wall came down, she had like this relative that wanted to come to Nuremberg to get a job. And so he stayed with her for some period of time. And he did not know any English. and I knew some German. So it was kind of hard to communicate with him, but I mean, it was, you know, at that point, what the wall had been up for, geez, a long time at that
point. Well, since 45, right?
I mean, yeah, so it
40
was,
years.
Yeah, you're talking 40 years, you know, I mean, and just, you know, some of the ways that they would talk, and even some of the German was different and everything. So he, in my opinion, he was just a little bit strange.
He probably thought you were pretty exotic too.
Yeah, he probably did. I bet he never imagined he'd be sitting there talking to an American.
Yeah, yeah. But it would have been good for both of you, I think.
No, I was glad to get to experience that.
Yeah.
And by that time, I knew some conversational German. And,
cool.
Yeah, so. Yeah, it was a good experience.
And what happened to the chatter you were listening to when the wall came down?
That's, you know, I got to be honest, I don't remember so much.
Okay.
There's nothing that really sticks out, but you would have thought there would be. You're right. But there's nothing that really sticks out that I would be like, wow. I just think they had become so ingrained on how they talked about things and stuff that they wouldn't have been revealing stuff on radio.
Okay.
You know, they were more careful. I mean, people maybe don't remember, but I mean, East Germany and the Russians, they were pretty bad people.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it didn't go well.
No, it was pretty bad and people had to be very careful. So. Yeah, I think they just were very careful about what they'd say.
Right, right. What else do you remember about that wall coming down that might have surprised you, or you look back now on and go, it was pretty amazing to see?
Well, for me, I never got to go East Germany because I had a top secret clearance and they wouldn't let me. They wouldn't let me go over there.
Okay.
And I couldn't cross the border and stuff. But then, when my daughter graduated high school, when I was in 2017, we went to Germany and we went to what was East Germany and I went to Berlin. And, I guess the biggest thing for me was it was just to see what Berlin's like now compared to what it was like back then. It's just, I don't know, it's a much different place. And then,
let's open that up. What did you see? What were the differences?
Well, I mean, there was obviously a big wall. And it snaked all around through Berlin there. And it was, you know, on the West German side, it was totally covered with graffiti but there were places along there where they would have these viewing platforms where you could go up and you could look over the wall to see the other side, you know?
Huh.
And,
did the East Germans have that as well or not?
No.
Huh.
They weren't
allowed. They yeah.
No, they wouldn't. Yeah, it was a very, because there was a, most places there was like this gap between the wall, you know, and then another fence. And so they weren't even allowed to get even close to the wall.
Got it.
And you know, maybe in some of the higher rise buildings they could have got up and seen over to the other side.
Right.
But it was just, because, you know, Berlin, a lot of Berlin. Land had to get rebuilt after the war.
Right.
And the West Berlin was a fully modern city.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful city, but East Berlin was, well, kind of like what the communists did. They just put up buildings and there wasn't anything, beautiful by any means. But now when you go there, I mean, if you didn't know any better, you wouldn't know that there was any difference between the
wow.
two.
Wow. And so for you, that big wall snaking through town was gone, I'm assuming. When you...
Oh, yeah, it's all gone, except wow. for a few remnants as kind of a memorial and stuff.
Right.
And, you know, there's Checkpoint Charlie, which, they have to have a museum there and stuff. But, I mean, it's just nothing like what it was.
Mm.
So,
wow.
Yeah. And East Germany, I mean, I got to travel some in East Germany, and, I mean, obviously, the country of Germany has spent a lot of money.
Yeah.
Modernizing what was East Germany.
Right.
It's all a modern country now.
That woman that you befriended, did she pass on by the time you came back in 2017?
You know, I when I came back, we wrote some letters, and then one time we even had a phone call.
Mm.
And time went on, and I would write her a letter, and then never hear anything back from her. So I assume that she died.
Okay.
And then, but I went to the little town where she lived. And, she wasn't there. She would have been pretty old by that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, that's too bad. I lost connection that way, but. So the wall came down in 89. You're on a 4-year tour that's probably going to time out in 1990?
Yeah. My whole tour with the Army would have ended in April 1st of 1990, but they had a thing where if you had enough leave, you could take terminal leave, and I had a month's worth, so I actually got to get out of the Army like beginning of March or something like that.
Okay.
But I stayed in Germany because I was still technically in the Army, and I could, they have a thing where you can get on these flights for like $10. So, like I went up to Frankfurt and got on a military flight, and took me down to Athens.
Oh, wow.
And then I got to go to Turkey. And,
whoa, what was that like?
Oh, that's pretty interesting. I got a flight into, I forget the Air Force base in Turkey there. And then I got another flight that took me up to Istanbul.
Okay.
And it was, as we were flying, one of the things that stuck out as we were flying into Istanbul, in a C-130, you could smell Istanbul as you were flying into me.
Huh.
But then I got to, I spent a few days there in Istanbul and really enjoyed it. It's an amazing city.
Cool.
And then I think from there I went back to Athens. Then I got another flight to Tel Aviv traveled around in Israel for a while.
What was that like?
I'm really glad that I got to go there. It was, so this was, 1990, and obviously there's been, strife with the Palestinians for a long time, but
yeah.
But back then it wasn't anything like what it's now. No. You know?
Yeah.
So you needed to be a little careful, but I traveled all around in Israel, mostly by buses and stuff.
Okay.
And, I'm really glad I got to go there. It was, a place that you hear a lot about, but you really need to go there and see it for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Understanding Russian, on your travels around Europe, did that help you at all?
No, I gotta say, probably didn't really. No, if anything, probably German helped more than the Russian did.
Yeah. Well, especially in Turkey, where there's a lot of Germans.
I didn't. Just any really there, but
okay.
Obviously, Austria and Germany, but yeah, a lot of places speak English, which is fortunate.
Yeah, so. That's right.
Yeah. And then I went to, down through the Sinai into Cairo.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then made my way back to Israel and then gradually made my way back up to Germany again.
All the time you're on paid leave.
Yeah, and I was still in the Army so I could take advantage of all those things. And then I actually officially got out of the Army back in Nuremberg.
Okay. So. Nice.
Yeah.
What was your rank on discharge?
I was a sergeant.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And did you have $6,000 saved up?
I had more than that because one of the things about with my job with once you made it through the schools, you got like a $7,000 bonus. So,
wow.
But that's nothing compared to the bonuses they offer nowadays. But yeah, I had that. And then, I didn't have a lot of expenses. And even though I wasn't making that much money, I think by the time I got out of the Army, I had 20 some thousand dollars saved up.
So, nice.
Yeah.
What were you thinking you were going to do, traveling through Europe, gotten that last month? Do you have any idea where you're going to go and what you're thinking to do?
Well, that's a good question. I'd kind of gotten discouraged about getting a Forest Service job. So then I thought, well, I'll go get my teaching certificate. And so that became my plan. And I got out of the Army and I went to Washington State, Western Washington, and there's a university there in Bellingham.
Yeah.
And I went there for a couple of quarters working on getting my teaching certificate.
I've got to ask you because the world is mighty small sometimes. Was a woman there in the library named Janet Collins.
Huh. At the university?
University Bellingham, Western Washington University Bellingham, in the map library there. There were thousands of other people there.
Yeah, I might have run into her. I spent my time in the library because, that's where I did my studying at.
Okay.
But I don't recall.
Now you had a bachelor's already in forestry.
Yes, I did.
And now you've got this military training for Russian.
Yes.
What sort of class was a teacher's certificate in reach? Like after a year or a year and a half's worth of schooling?
Yeah, I think it was going to take me a year or something like that.
Okay.
Because I had to take some education classes because I didn't have any.
Right.
Yeah, and even though I enjoyed some of those classes, I just started to wonder, well, is this really for me? And I was kind of hemming and hawing about it. And then all of a sudden, the Forest Service called me up and offered me another seasonal job in North Bend, Washington. And I just decided, well, I'll take a break from the college thing, go do that.
How did you get that call? Had you reached out to any of your Forest Service contacts when you got back to the States just to see what was going on, or how did they know you were there?
I think it was because when I first got out of the Army and I got back up there, I was allowed to be on unemployment for, I don't know, 60 days or something like that. And the unemployment office had my name and stuff.
Okay.
And I think that the Forest Service just checked with the unemployment office if there were people wanting any forestry jobs, and that, and they got my name, and that's how it happened.
Had you given a resume to the unemployment office? Because
yeah,
that would have showed the Forest Service connection there, and they would have looked at that and said, hey, this guy's got...
I think that's exactly how it happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
Huh. And they offered you a seasonal firefighting position?
No, this was in silviculture, which basically meant a lot of different things. We were out doing stand plots and planting trees and all kinds of different stuff.
Were you on a survey crew for logging?
No.
Because you'd done that in the past.
Yeah.
You knew that.
Yeah, I had, but this more involved taking stand data, going out and doing stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a good job.
Would have been for the summer of 1990?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's right. Yep.
Where's North Bend?
North Bend is probably about 30 miles east of Seattle. On the interstate, heading up towards Snoqualmie Pass there.
Okay. And what is it, Leavenworth? What's the name of the...
Leavenworth's on the other
side. On the other side.
July.
Right.
Yeah.
So big trees, conifer...
Oh, yeah, big trees.
Got it.
Yeah,
wow.
Big, beautiful trees.
Okay.
And but that was also right around the time of the whole spotted owl thing.
Oh.
And so that was starting to happen, and it was like, well, people were being scared they're going to lose their jobs and stuff. Rightfully so, because that eventually happened, like a couple year or two later. But then once again, I had an application in, and I got offered a permanent job with the Defense Mapping Agency in Washington, D.C., which was a big change, but I just decided to do it, and so...
Okay, so hang on a second. Let's back up a minute.
Yeah.
I got to make sure I'm filling these dots in correctly.
So I've got a lot of moves in my life.
Beth, this is lovely, but I just want to make sure, because you're like, all right, I'm kind of thinking about a teaching certificate, took some classes, but that didn't seem like it was kind of uncertain about that. Then took the seasonal job for the summer into the early fall 1990 out of North Bend. How did this job come up with defense mapping?
I don't really remember. I think what it was is my younger brother had a job with them when he got out of college.
Okay.
And I think he told me, well, you should send him an application or something, which I think that's what I did. And And then, lo and behold, they offered me the job. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And did you know what you were signing up for? What was the job?
It's a cartographer job.
Okay.
And
So that's making maps, right? Using 3D imagery
right.
and all that stuff. And this was like, there was some really interesting state-of-the-art changes going on in mapping.
You're exactly right.
Ooh.
So I went, traveled, you know, moved all the way across the country. That's when I realized, oh my goodness, this really is a big country.
From Washington State to Washington, D.C., you bet.
Yeah, it takes a little bit of time to do that trip. And so I got there and started the job. And for the first, I think it was probably about 30 days, I guess, maybe 60, 30 days. Where we would go to was the Naval Observatory, which is in D.C. there, and that's where we got our training.
Cool.
And the Naval Observatory is also where the Vice President's residence is at.
Oh, wow.
And so once you got through the gate there, I mean, you could walk around the grounds. At lunchtime, go for walks sometimes, walk by the Vice President's house, and George Bush, when he was Vice President, had built this kind of like a paved running track that went through the woods there, and so you could go for walks on that. But we went through training, and it's like you're saying, we were kind of being exposed to the old-fashioned way of making maps, but then at the same time, GIS was coming around.
Right.
And so we really kind of had to learn both of them.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, GIS was just a game changer.
Yeah.
Compared to, I really had no idea how they made topo maps and stuff before that, but it's a laborious project. Yeah,
with the photographs and the stereoscopic glasses and
well, they had these big tables that were, you're right, you'd follow the line on the stereoscope. Yeah, it was very, I mean, it, young people nowadays would have, wouldn't they be able to fathom what it used to be like?
Talking about probably, they're like, what? But I'm curious. I'm curious about a couple things. One was, who was the Vice President at that time?
Let's see, Quayle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dan Quayle, right.
Yeah, Dan Quayle was still the Vice President.
Did you see him from afar any time when you were
I there? Never did.
Okay.
I never did.
Okay.
And there was no... there was no guards or anything around because the whole thing's within a, you know, a fenced compound.
Right.
I'm sure there were sensors or something if you actually tried to go up and look in a window or something like that. But
right. You know, the cartographer job, was that working with the United States Geological Survey or who was your boss?
No, it was the Defense Mapping Agency.
Okay. Sorry, you mentioned that.
So
in a way, you had a high-level security clearance. Did that help you, your military security clearance here in defense mapping? Was that required or not at all?
Yeah, no, I had to have another top secret clearance working for them.
Okay.
So then when I got done with my training, then I went to this other big building that they have, and I worked in this basement, where it was a secure facility and all that. And what we did down there is there was these mapping products that we would put together, and then we would ship them off to, you know, ships and bases all around the world and stuff.
So you were making maps of other parts of the planet?
Yeah.
Got it.
And this was not long after the whole the Gulf War thing, right?
Okay.
And so they had been really busy during that time. But then that was over with, and so things had kind of settled down. But they had gone through a real crazy time because they hadn't, you know, the military didn't have a lot of maps and stuff of that part of the world, and so they had to produce a lot of stuff. So.
Wow. Yeah, you have to work fast to try to make a map of.
Yeah, and it's all got to be classified, right? Because you don't want the word getting out that you're working on a maps of a certain part of the world.
Right.
Before
the military event happens.
Exactly. Yeah. But once again, I was like, well, I don't know if this is for me or not.
Working in a basement just doesn't sound like that's your style.
No, you're exactly right. I was like, is this what I want to do? And I appreciated getting to see all the things around D.C., but I didn't really think that was a place I wanted to live for a long time. And then, totally out of the blue, I got offered a job, a permanent job, with the Forest Service on the Ozark National Forest in Arkansas.
How did that happen?
Well, because back in those days, they had a, what was it called? It was a list, basically, a roster that, like, they had a forester roster, and you would, fill out all your information, all that, and they would give you this point score. And so back then, the government filled a lot of jobs with these rosters. So my name showed up on this roster, and they hired me. So,
wow,
it was just kind of out of the blue.
Did you know you were on the roster list and that you might be offered other jobs?
I did know I was on the roster.
Okay.
I didn't. You never know by your score. If for any given job, if your points are going to be high enough or not. So you just don't know until it happens.
Yes, but my heavens, you've got a degree in forestry, you've got seasonal activity, you've got military service. I mean, you've got all the points just cashing in there.
Yeah, I pretty high score, and so it worked out for me.
Yeah,
and then I think not long after that, they got rid of that whole system.
Oh, okay.
The whole roster thing. So, here's one other deal that because I had been into the roster had been closed for some period of time, but because I had been in the military, they allowed me to get my name added to that roster.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it all was just kind of a fluke and it worked out for me. So
how long were you in with the mapping division there?
For like 8 months.
8 months, okay.
Yeah.
You know, before we leave that, the mapping that was done with the big tables and the stereoscopic follow the line, did you transition out of that into the more GIS stuff? Did that happen then?
I would have been.
Okay.
That probably would have been the next thing I would have been doing. Because, you know, Defense Mapping Agency, they were kind of on the leading edge of all that GIS stuff and everything. And so it was majorly transitioning towards that.
So you must have seen it coming, but didn't necessarily get the training.
But it was pretty clunky back then compared to, you know, what they have nowadays.
Yeah, it's just, well, we're all, nowadays, a lot of what GIS is doing is working off of, you know, that old plane table work.
Yes.
And just, well, I don't know, I shouldn't say much about it, because I don't know that much about it. But.
Well, it's totally different than,
yeah,
you know, what the work that had to go into creating a topo map back then, you know, it's just...
Right.
Yeah.
And the layers now, all the...
All the stuff, yeah.
Different stuff you can put on a map. And,
yeah.
But the fundamental base work for that, and it goes back to that other stuff, so it's kind of fun.
Yeah, it does.
So the Ozarks, were you like, oh boy, I get to go to the jungle? I mean,
you know, I had never been in Arkansas before I got offered that job.
Really?
That.
Okay.
I had never been. I had no idea what I was getting into. I mean, no idea. But
what was the job offered?
It was called a forester trainee. So, you'd start out at like a GS5, and then in a year you get to be a 7, and then in another year you get to be a GS9, which is kind of like the journey level for a forester, you know.
Yeah, the 5-7-9 bump up, sure.
Yes, yeah. So that's what I was.
Okay.
So I was there for 2 years to teach me how to be a forester.
Was this like a training school?
No, I was just at a district.
Okay.
I was working out at a district there, and got a lot of good experience doing a lot of different things.
What kind of forest was it?
Well, the Ozark is it's a mix of pine and hardwood.
Okay.
And it has, you know, they call it the Ozark Mountains. I mean, basically big hills, but a lot of cliff lines and rocks and, it's really pretty, I thought. And like, you know, after rain events, there were just waterfalls all over the place and stuff. And the Buffalo River, which is a national scenic river run by the Park Service, it went right through there where I worked.
Oh, wow.
And people from all over take canoe trips down that and stuff. And, but I mean, it's also the, you know, rural South and, you know, a little town that I lived in, which was Jasper, Arkansas. A county seat, but I don't know if they had even 500 people there, I doubt. You know, it's a dry county, and every county around it was a dry county. And so, you know, here I was, relatively young guy, single guy. And, as far as like, social or nightlife, there wasn't much of that.
You know, after coming from Berlin, that would have been quite the...
yeah, it took some getting used to, let's put it that way.
Huh.
Yeah.
You know, Dave, we've been visiting for a little over an hour here, and I wonder if this is a good place to put a comma in this interview series, because it's going to be a change from Washington, D.C. To Arkansas, and then we can pick that up next time of what that was like.
Okay, yeah, we can do that.
Is there anything in what we've covered that you want to bring in here that I didn't ask you? Okay.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. All right, with that, let's conclude part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with David Mertz. Today is Monday. It's August 25th, 2025. My name is Tom Martin, and Dave, thank you so very much.
Well, you're welcome.